he answered slightly. "But working under such a gentleman, they don't follow you to the factory."
"No, no, they didn't follow him there," said Stephen. "All correct there. Everything accordant there." He did not go so far as to say for her pleasure that there was a sort of divine right there, but I have heard claims almost as magnificent of late years. They were now in the black by-road near the place, and the hands were crowding in. The bell was ringing, and the serpent was a serpent of many coils, and the elephant was getting ready. The strange old woman was delighted with the very bell. It was the beautifulest bell she had ever heard, she said, and sounded grand. She asked him, when he stopped good-naturedly to shake hands with her before going in, how long had he worked there?
12 years, he told her.
"I must kiss the hand," said she, "that has worked in this fine factory for 12 years. And she lifted it, though he would have prevented her, and put it to her lips. What harmony, besides her age and her simplicity, surrounded her, he did not know. But even in this fantastic action, there was a something neither out of time nor place, a something which it seemed as if nobody else could have made as serious, or done with such a natural and touching air. He had been at his loom full 30 minutes, thinking about this old woman, when, having occasion to move round the loom for its adjustment, he glanced through a window which was in his corner, and saw her still looking up at the pile of building, lost in admiration. Heedless of the smoke and mud and wet, and of her 2 long journeys, she was gazing at it, as if the heavy thrum that issued from its many stories were proud music to her. She was gone by and by, and the day went after her, and the lights sprung up again, and the express whirled in full sight of the fairy palace over the arches near, little felt amid the jarring of the machinery, and scarcely heard above its crash and rattle. Long before then, his thoughts had gone back to the dreary room above the little shop, and to the shameful figure heavy on the bed, but heavier on his heart. Machinery slackened, throbbing feebly like a fainting pulse, stopped. The bell again. The glare of light and heat dispelled, the factories looming heavy in the black wet night, their tall chimneys rising up into the air like competing towers of Babel. He had spoken to Rachel only last night, it was true, and had walked with her a little way, but he had his new misfortune on him, in which no one else could give him a moment's relief, and for the sake of it, and because he knew himself to want that softening of his anger, which no voice but hers could effect, he felt he might so far disregard what she had said as to wait for her again. He waited, but she had eluded him. She was gone. On no other night in the year could he so ill have spared her patient face. Oh, better to have no home in which to lay his head than to have a home and dread to go to it through such a cause. He ate and drank, for he was exhausted, but he little knew or cared what, and he wandered about in the chill rain, thinking and thinking, and brooding and brooding. No word of a new marriage had ever passed between them, but Rachel had taken great pity on him years ago, and to her alone he had opened his closed heart all this time on the subject of his miseries, and he knew very well that if he were free to ask her, she would take him. He thought of the home he might at that moment have been seeking with pleasure and pride, of the different man he might have been that night, of the lightness then in his now heavy-laden breast, of the then restored honour, self-respect and tranquillity all torn to pieces. He thought of the waste of the best part of his life, of the change it made in his character for the worse every day, of the dreadful nature of his existence, bound hand and foot to a dead woman, and tormented by a demon in her shape. He thought of Rachel, how young when they were first brought together in these circumstances, how mature now, how soon to grow old. He thought of the number of girls and women she had seen marry, how many homes with children in them she had seen grow up around her, how she had contentedly pursued her own lone, quiet path for him, and how he had sometimes seen a shade of melancholy on her blessed face that smote him with remorse and despair. He set the picture of her
up beside the infamous image of last night, and thought, could it be that the whole earthly course of one so gentle, good, and self-denying was subjugate to such a wretch as that? Filled with these thoughts, so filled that he had an unwholesome sense of growing larger, of being placed in some new and diseased relation towards the objects among which he passed, of seeing the iris round every misty light turn red, he went home for shelter. Chapter 13. Rachel. A candle faintly burned in the window, to which the black ladder had often been raised for the sliding away of all that was most precious in this world to a striving wife and a brood of hungry babies. And Stephen added to his other thoughts the stern reflection that of all the casualties of this existence upon earth, not one was dealt out with so unequal a hand as death. The inequality of birth was nothing to it. For say that the child of a king and the child of a weaver were born tonight in the same moment, what was that disparity to the death of any human creature who was serviceable to or beloved by another, while this abandoned woman lived on? From the outside of his home, he gloomily passed to the inside, with suspended breath and with a slow footstep. He went up to his door, opened it, and so into the room. Quiet and peace were there. Rachel was there, sitting by the bed. She turned her head, and the light of her face shone in upon the midnight of his mind. She sat by the bed, watching and tending his wife. That is to say, he saw that someone lay there, and he knew too well it must be she. But Rachel's hands had put a curtain up, so that she was screened from his eyes. Her disgraceful garments were removed, and some of Rachel's were in the room. Everything was in its place and order as he had always kept it. The little fire was newly trimmed, and the hearth was freshly swept. It appeared to him that he saw all this in Rachel's face, and looked at nothing besides. While looking at it, it was shut out from his view by the softened tears that filled his eyes, but not before he had seen how earnestly she looked at him, and how her own eyes were filled too. She turned again towards the bed, and satisfying herself that all was quiet there, spoke in a low, calm, cheerful voice. "I am glad you have come at last, Stephen. You are very late." "I have been walking up and down." "I thought so. But 'tis too bad a night for that. The rain falls very heavy, and the wind has risen."
"The wind? True, it was blowing hard. Hark to the thundering in the chimney, and the surging noise. To have been out in such a wind and not to have known it was blowing."
"I have been here once before today, Stephen. Landlady came round for me at dinner time. There was someone here that needed looking to," she said. "Indeed, she was right. All wandering and lost, Stephen. Wounded too and bruised."
He slowly moved to a chair and sat down, drooping his head before her.
"I came to do what little I could, Stephen. First, for that you worked with me when we were girls both, and for that you courted her and married her when I was her friend."
He laid his furrowed forehead on his hand with a low groan.
"And next, for that I know your heart, and am right sure and certain that 'tis far too merciful to let her die, or even so much as suffer for want of aid. Thou knowest who said, 'Let him who was without sin among you cast the first stone at her.' There have been plenty to do that. Thou art not the man to cast the last stone, Stephen, when she is brought so low. Oh, Rachel, Rachel, thou hast been a cruel sufferer. Heaven reward thee," she said, in compassionate accents. "I am thy poor friend, with all my heart and mind."
The wounds of which she had spoken seemed to be about the neck of the self-made outcast. She dressed them now, still without showing her. She steeped a piece of linen in a basin into which she poured some liquid from a bottle and laid it with a gentle hand upon the sore. The three-legged table had been drawn close to the bedside, and on it there were two bottles. This was one.
It was not so far off, but that Stephen, following her hands with his eyes, could read what was printed on it in large letters. He turned of a deadly hue, and a sudden horror seemed to fall upon him.
"I will stay here, Stephen," said Rachel, quietly resuming her seat, "till the bells go three. 'Tis to be done again at three, and then she may be left till morning.
But thy rest against tomorrow's work, my dear."
"I slept sound last night. I can wake many nights when I'm put to it. 'Tis thou who art in need of rest, sore white and tired. Try to sleep in the chair there, while I watch. Thou hadst no sleep last night, I can well believe. Tomorrow's work is far harder for thee than for me."
He heard the thundering and surging out of doors, and it seemed to him as if his late, angry mood were going about trying to get at him. She had cast it out. She would keep it out. He trusted to her to defend him from himself.
"She don't know me, Stephen. She just drowsily mutters and stares. I have spoken to her times and again, but she don't notice. 'Tis as well so. When she comes to her right mind once more, I shall have done what I can, and she never the wiser."
"How long, Rachel, is it looked for that she'll be so? Doctor said she would haply come to her mind tomorrow."
His eyes fell again on the bottle, and a tremble passed over him, causing him to shiver in every limb. She thought he was chilled with the wet. "No," he said, "it was not that. He had had a fright."
"A fright?"
Aye, coming in. When I were walking. When I were thinking. When I..." It seized him again, and he stood up, holding by the mantel shelf, as he pressed his dank, cold hair down with a hand that shook as if it were palsied.
"Stephen!"
She was coming to him, but he stretched out his arm to stop her.
"No, don't, please don't. Let me see thee sitting by the bed. Let me see thee all so good and so forgiven. Let me see thee as I see thee when I come in. I can never see thee better than so. Never, never, never."
He had a violent fit of trembling, and then sunk into his chair. After a time, he controlled himself, and resting with an elbow on one knee and his head upon that hand, could look towards Rachel. Seen across the dim candle with his moistened eyes, she looked as if she had a glory shining round her head. He could have believed she had. He did believe it, as the noise without shook the window, rattled at the door below, and went about the house, clamouring and lamenting.
"When she gets better, Stephen, 'tis to be hoped she'll leave thee to thyself again, and do thee no more hurt. Anyways, we'll hope so now. And now I shall keep silence, for I want thee to sleep."
He closed his eyes, more to please her than to rest his weary head. But by slow degrees, as he listened to the great noise of the wind, he ceased to hear it, or it changed into the working of his loom, or even into the voices of the day, his own included, saying what had been really said. Even this imperfect consciousness faded away at last, and he dreamed a long, troubled dream. He thought that he, and someone on whom his heart had long been set, but she was not Rachel, and that surprised him even in the midst of his imaginary happiness, stood in the church being married. While the ceremony was performing, and while he recognized among the witnesses some who he knew to be living, and many whom he knew to be dead, darkness came on, succeeded by the shining of a tremendous light. It broke from one line in the table of commandments at the altar, and illuminated the building with the words. They were sounded through the church too, as if there were voices in the fiery letters. Upon this, the whole appearance before him and around him changed, and nothing was left as it had been but himself and the clergyman. They stood in the daylight before a crowd so vast that if all the people in the world could have been brought together into one space, they could not have looked, he thought, more numerous. And they all abhorred him, and there was not one pitying or friendly eye among the millions that were fastened on his face. He stood on a raised stage, under his own loom, and looking up at the shape the loom took, and hearing the burial service distinctly read, he knew that he was there to suffer death. In an instant, what he stood on fell below him. and he was gone. Out of what mystery he came back to his usual life and to places that he knew, he was unable to consider, but he was back in those places by some means, and with this condemnation upon him, that he was never, in this world or the next, through all the unimaginable ages of eternity, to look on Rachel's face or hear her voice. Wandering to and fro, unceasingly, without hope, and in search of he knew not what, he only knew that he was doomed to seek it, he was the subject of a nameless, horrible dread, a mortal fear of one particular shape which everything took. Whatsoever he looked at grew into that form sooner or later. The object of his miserable existence was to prevent its recognition by any one among the various people he encountered. Hopeless labor. If he led them out of rooms where it was, if he shut up drawers and closets where it stood, if he drew the curious from places where he knew it to be secreted and got them out into the streets, the very chimneys of the mills assumed that shape, and round them was the printed word. The wind was blowing again, the rain was beating on the housetops, and the larger spaces through which he had strayed contracted to the four walls of his room. Saving that the fire had died out, it was as his eyes had closed upon it. Rachel seemed to have fallen into a doze in the chair by the bed. She sat wrapped in her shawl, perfectly still. The table stood in the same place, close by the bedside, and on it, in its real proportions and appearance, was the shape so often repeated. He thought he saw the curtain move. He looked again, and he was sure it moved. He saw a hand come forth and grope about a little. Then the curtain moved more perceptibly, and the woman in the bed put it back and sat up. With her woeful eyes so haggard and wild, so heavy and large, she looked all round the room and past the corner where he slept in his chair. Her eyes returned to that corner, and she put her hand over them as a shade while she looked into it. Again they went all round the room, scarcely heeding Rachel, if at all, and returned to that corner. He thought as she once more shaded them, not so much looking at him as looking for him, with a brutish instinct that he was there, that no single trace was left in those debauched features, or in the mind that went along with them, of the woman he had married 18 years before. But that he had seen her come to this by inches, he never could have believed her to be the same. All this time, as if a spell were on him, he was motionless and powerless except to watch her. Stupidly dozing, or communing with her incapable self about nothing, she sat for a little while with her hands at her ears and her head resting on them. Presently, she resumed her staring round the room. And now, for the first time, her eyes stopped at the table with the bottles on it. Straightway, she turned her eyes back to his corner with the defiance of last night, and moving very cautiously and softly, stretched out her greedy hand. She drew a mug into the bed, and sat for a while considering which of the two bottles she should choose. Finally, she laid her insensate grasp upon the bottle that had swift and certain death in it, and before his eyes, pulled out the cork with her teeth. Dream or reality, he had no voice, nor had he power to stir. If this be real, and her allotted time be not yet come, wake, Rachel, wake. She thought of that too. She looked at Rachel, and very slowly, very cautiously, poured out the contents. The draught was at her lips. A moment, and she would be past all help. Let the whole world wake and come about her with its utmost power. But in that moment, Rachel started up with a suppressed cry. The creature struggled, struck her, seized her by the hair, but Rachel had the cup. Stephen broke out of his chair.
Rachel, I'm awaking or dreaming this dreadful night. 'Tis all well, Stephen. I have been asleep myself. 'Tis near 3. Hush, I hear the bells.
The wind brought the sounds of the church clock to the window. They listened, and it struck 3. Stephen looked at her, saw how pale she was, noted the disorder of her hair and the red marks of fingers on her forehead, and felt assured that his senses of sight and hearing had been awake. She held the cup in her hand even now. "I thought it must be near 3, she said, calmly pouring from the cup into the basin and steeping the linen as before. "I am thankful I stayed. 'Tis done now, when I've put this on. There, and now she's quiet again. A few drops in the basin I'll pour away, for it's bad stuff to leave about, though ever so little of it." As she spoke, she drained the basin into the ashes of the fire and broke the bottle on the hearth. She had nothing to do then but to cover herself with her shawl before going out into the wind and rain. "Thou let me walk with thee at this hour, Rachel." "No, Stephen, 'tis but a minute and I'm home. Thou art not fearful," he said it in a low voice as they went out the door, "to leave me alone with her." As she looked at him, saying, "Stephen," he went down on his knee before her, on the poor, mean stairs, and put an end of her shawl to his lips. "Thou art an angel. Bless thee, bless thee. I am, as I have told thee, Stephen, thy poor friend. Angels are not like me. Between them and a working woman full of faults there is a deep gulf set. My little sister is among them, but she is changed." She raised her eyes for a moment as she said the words, and then they fell again in all their gentleness and mildness on his face. "Thou changest me from bad to good. Thou makest me humbly wishful to be more like thee, and fearful to lose thee when this life is over, and all the muddle cleared away. Thou art an angel. It may be thou hast saved my soul alive." She looked at him on his knee at her feet, with her shawl still in his hand, and the reproof on her lips died away when she saw the working of his face. "I come home desperate. I come home without a hope and mad with thinking that when I said a word of complaint, I was reckoned an unreasonable hand. I told thee I had had a fright. It was a poison bottle on the table. I never hurt a living creature, but happening so suddenly upon it, I thought, how can I say what I might have done to my son, or her, or both?" She put her two hands on his mouth, with a face of terror, to stop him from saying more. He caught them in his unoccupied hand, and holding them and still clasping the border of her shawl, said hurriedly, "But I see thee, Rachel, sitting by the bed. I've seen thee all this night. In my troublous sleep I've known thee still to be there. Evermore I will see thee there. I nevermore will see her or think of her, but thou shalt be beside her. I nevermore will see or think of anything that angers me, but thou, so much better than me, shalt be by the side on't. And so I will try to look to the time, and so I will try to trust to the time, when thou and me at last shall walk together far away, beyond the deep gulf, in the country where thy little sister is." He kissed the border of her shawl again and let her go. She bade him good night in a broken voice and went out into the street. The wind blew from the quarter where the day would soon appear, and still blew strongly. It had cleared the sky before it, and the rain had spent itself or travelled elsewhere, and the stars were bright. He stood bareheaded in the road, watching her quick disappearance, as the shining stars were to the heavy candle in the window. So was Rachel, in the rugged fancy of this man, to the common experiences of his life. Chapter 14. The Great Manufacturer. Time went on in Coketown, like its own machinery. So much material wrought up, so much fuel consumed, so many powers worn out, so much money made. But less inexorable than iron, steel, and brass, it brought its varying seasons even into that wilderness of smoke and brick, and made the only stand that ever was made in the place against its direful uniformity. "Louisa is becoming," said Mr. Gradgrind, "almost a young woman." Time, with his innumerable horsepower, worked away, not minding what anybody said, and presently turned out young Thomas, a foot taller than when his father had last taken particular notice of him.
"Thomas is becoming," said Mr. Gradgrind, "almost a young man."
Time passed Thomas on in the mill, while his father was thinking about it, and there he stood in a long-tailed coat and a stiff shirt collar.
"Really," said Mr. Gradgrind, "the period has arrived when Thomas ought to go to Bounderby."
Time, sticking to him, passed him on into Bounderby's bank, made him an inmate of Bounderby's house, necessitated the purchase of his first razor, and exercised him diligently in his calculations relative to number one. The same great manufacturer, always with an immense variety of work on hand in every stage of development, passed Sissy onward in his mill, and worked her up into a very pretty article indeed.
"I fear, Jupe," said Mr. Gradgrind, "that your continuance at the school any longer would be useless."
"I am afraid it would, sir," Sissy answered with a curtsy.
"I cannot disguise from you, Jupe," said Mr. Gradgrind, knitting his brow, "that the result of your probation there has disappointed me, has greatly disappointed me. You have not acquired under Mr. and Mrs. Machocomchild anything like that amount of exact knowledge which I looked for. You are extremely deficient in your facts. Your acquaintance with figures is very limited. You are altogether backward and below the mark."
"I am sorry, sir," she returned, "but I know it's quite true. Yet I have tried hard, sir."
"Yes," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Yes, I believe you have tried hard. I have observed you, and I can find no fault in that respect."
"Thank you, sir. I have thought sometimes," Sissy very timid here, "that perhaps I tried to learn too much, and that if I had asked to be allowed to try a little less, I might have—"
"No, Jupe, no," said Mr. Gradgrind, shaking his head in his profoundest and most eminently practical way. "No. The course you pursued according to the system, and there is no more to be said about it. I can only suppose that the circumstances of your early life were too unfavourable to the development of your reasoning powers, and that we began too late. Still, as I have said already, I am disappointed."
"I wish I could have made a better acknowledgement, sir, of your kindness to a poor, forlorn girl who had no claim upon you and of your protection of her."
"Don't shed tears," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Don't shed tears.
I don't complain of you. You are an affectionate, earnest, good young woman, and we must make that do." "Thank you, sir, very much," said Sissy, with a grateful curtsy.
"You are useful to Mrs. Gradgrind, and in a generally pervading way, you are serviceable in the family also. So I understand from Miss Louisa, and indeed so I have observed myself. I therefore hope," said Mr. Gradgrind, "that you can make yourself happy in those relations."
"I should have nothing to wish, sir, if—"
"I understand you," said Mr. Gradgrind. "You still refer to your father. I have heard from Miss Louisa that you still preserve that bottle. Well, if your training in the science of arriving at exact results had been more successful, you would have been wiser on these points. I will say no more."
He really liked Sissy too well to have a contempt for her. Otherwise, he held her calculating powers in such very slight estimation that he must have fallen upon that conclusion. Somehow or other, he had become possessed by an idea that there was something in this girl which could hardly be set forth in a tabular form. Her capacity of definition might be easily stated at a very low figure, her mathematical knowledge at nothing. Yet he was not sure that if he had been required, for example, to tick her off into columns in a parliamentary return, he would have quite known how to divide her. In some stages of his manufacture of the human fabric, the processes of time are very rapid. Young Thomas and Sissy being both at such a stage of their working up, these changes were effected in a year or two, while Mr. Gradgrind himself seemed stationary in his course, and underwent no alteration. Except one, which was apart from his necessary progress through the mill. Time hustled him into a little noisy and rather dirty machinery in a bycomer, and made him Member of Parliament for Coketown, one of the respected members for Ounce, Weights and Measures, one of the representatives of the multiplication table, one of the deaf honourable gentlemen, dumb honourable gentlemen, blind honourable gentlemen, lame honourable gentlemen, dead honourable gentlemen to every other consideration. Else wherefore live we in a Christian land 1800 and odd years after our master? All this while, Louisa had been passing on so quiet and reserved, and so much given to watching the bright ashes at twilight as they fell into the grate and became extinct, that from the period when her father had said she was almost a young woman, which seemed but yesterday, she had scarcely attracted his notice again, when he found her quite a young woman.
"Quite a young woman," said Mr. Gradgrind, musing. "Dear me."
Soon after this discovery, he became more thoughtful than usual for several days, and seemed much engrossed by one subject. On a certain night, when he was going out and Louisa came to bid him good-bye before his departure, as he was not to be home until late and she would not see him again until the morning, he held her in his arms, looking at her in his kindest manner, and said, "My dear Louisa, you are a woman." She answered with the old, quick, searching look of the night when she was found at the circus, then cast down her eyes. "Yes, father." "My dear," said Mr. Gradgrind, "I must speak with you alone and seriously. Come to me in my room after breakfast tomorrow, will you?"
"Yes, father."
"Your hands are rather cold, Louisa. Are you not well?"
"Quite well, father."
"And cheerful?" She looked at him again and smiled in her peculiar manner. "I am as cheerful, father, as I usually am, or usually have been."
"That's well," said Mr. Gradgrind.
So he kissed her and went away, and Louisa returned to the serene apartment of the hair-cutting character, and leaning her elbow on her hand, looked again at the short-lived sparks that so soon subsided into ashes. "Are you there, Lou?" said her brother, looking in at the door. He was quite a young gentleman of pleasure now, and not quite a prepossessing one.
"Dear Tom," she answered, rising and embracing him, "how long it is since you have been to see me."
"Why, I have been otherwise engaged, Lou, in the evenings, and in the daytime old Bounderby has been keeping me at it, rather. But I touch him up with you when he comes it too strong, and so we preserve an understanding. I say, has father said anything particular to you today or yesterday, Lou?"
"No, Tom, but he told me tonight that he wished to do so in the morning."
"Ah, that's what I mean," said Tom. "Do you know where he is tonight?" with a very deep expression.
"No."
"Then I'll tell you. He's with old Bounderby. They are having a regular confab together up at the bank." "Why at the bank, do you think?" "Well, I'll tell you again. To keep Mrs. Sparsit's ears as far off as possible, I expect."
With her hand upon her brother's shoulder, Louisa still stood looking at the fire. Her brother glanced at her face with greater interest than usual, and encircling her waist with his arm, drew her coaxingly to him.
"You are very fond of me, aren't you, Lou?"
"Indeed I am, Tom, though you do let such long intervals go by without coming to see me."
"Well, sister of mine," said Tom, "when you say that, you are near my thoughts. We might be so much oftener together, mightn't we? Always together, almost, mightn't we? It would do me a great deal of good if you were to make up your mind to I know what, Lou. It would be a splendid thing for me. It would be uncommonly jolly."
Her thoughtfulness baffled his cunning scrutiny. He could make nothing of her face. He pressed her in his arm and kissed her cheek. She returned the kiss, but still looked at the fire.
"I say, Lou, I thought I'd come and just hint to you what was going on, though I supposed you'd most likely guess, even if you didn't know. I can't stay because I'm engaged to some fellows tonight. You won't forget how fond you are of me?"
"No, dear Tom, I won't forget."
"That's a capital girl," said Tom.
"Goodbye, Lou."
She gave him an affectionate good night and went out with him to the door, whence the fires of Coketown could be seen making the distance lurid.
She stood there, looking steadfastly towards them and listening to his departing steps. They retreated quickly, as glad to get away from Stone Lodge, and she stood there yet, when he was gone and all was quiet. It seemed as if, first in her own fire within the house,
and then in the fiery haze without, she tried to discover what kind of woof old time, that greatest and longest established spinner of all, would weave from the threads he had already spun into a woman. But his factory is a secret place. His work is noiseless, and his hands are mutes. Chapter 15. Father and Daughter. Although Mr. Gradgrind did not take after Bluebeard, his room was quite a blue chamber in its abundance of blue books. Whatever they could prove, which is usually anything you like, they proved there in an army constantly strengthening by the arrival of new recruits. In that charmed apartment, the most complicated social questions were cast up, got into exact totals, and finally settled, if those concerned could only have been brought to know it. As if an astronomical observatory should be made without any windows, and the astronomer within should arrange the starry universe solely by pen, ink, and paper, so Mr. Gradgrind, in his observatory, and there are many like it, had no need to cast an eye upon the teeming myriads of human beings around him, but could settle all their destinies on a slate, and wipe out all their tears with one dirty little bit of sponge. To this observatory, then, a stern room with a deadly statistical clock in it which measured every second with a beat like a rap upon a coffin lid, Louisa repaired on the appointed morning. A window looked towards Coketown, and when she sat down near her father's table, she saw the high chimneys and the long tracts of smoke looming in the heavy distance gloomily. "My dear Louisa," said her father, "I prepared you last night to give me your serious attention in the conversation we are now going to have together. You have been so well trained, and you do, I am happy to say, so much justice to the education you have received, that I have perfect confidence in your good sense. You are not impulsive, you are not romantic, you are accustomed to view everything from the strong, dispassionate ground of reason and calculation. From that ground alone, I know you will view and consider what I am going to communicate." He waited, as if he would have been glad that she said something, but she said never a word. "Louisa, my dear, you are the subject of a proposal of marriage that has been made to me." Again he waited, and again she answered not one word. This so far surprised him as to induce him gently to repeat, "A proposal of marriage, my dear." To which she returned without any visible emotion whatever, "I hear you, father. I am attending, I assure you." "Well," said Mr. Gradgrind, breaking into a smile after being for the moment at a loss, "you are even more dispassionate than I expected, Louisa. Or perhaps you are not unprepared for the announcement I have it in charge to make." "I cannot say that, father, until I hear it. Prepared or unprepared, I wish to hear it all from you. I wish to hear you state it to me, father." Strange to relate, Mr. Gradgrind was not so collected at this moment as his daughter was. He took a paper knife in his hand, turned it over, laid it down, took it up again, and even then had to look along the blade of it, considering how to go on. "What you say, my dear Louisa, is perfectly reasonable. I have undertaken, then, to let you know that, in short, that Mr. Bounderby has informed me that he has long watched your progress with particular interest and pleasure, and has long hoped that the time might ultimately arrive when he should offer you his hand in marriage. That time, to which he has so long and certainly with great constancy looked forward, is now come. Mr. Bounderby has made his proposal of marriage to me, and has entreated me to make it known to you and to express his hope that you will take it into your favourable consideration." Silence between them. The deadly statistical clock, very hollow. The distant smoke, very black and heavy. "Father," said Louisa, "do you think I love Mr. Bounderby?" Mr. Gradgrind was extremely discomfited by this unexpected question. "Well, my child," he returned, "I really cannot take upon myself to say." "Father," pursued Louisa in exactly the same voice as before, "do you ask me to love Mr. Bounderby?" "My dear Louisa, no, no, I ask nothing.
Father, she still pursued, does Mr. Bounderby ask me to love him?
Really, my dear, said Mr. Gradgrind, it is difficult to answer your question.
Difficult to answer it yes or no, Father.
Certainly, my dear, because... Here was something to demonstrate, and it set him up again. Because the reply depends so materially, Louisa, on the sense in which we use the expression. Now, Mr. Bounderby does not do you the injustice, and does not do himself the injustice, of pretending to anything fanciful, fantastic, or, I am using synonymous terms, sentimental. Mr. Bounderby would have seen you grow up under his eyes to very little purpose if he could so far forget what is due to your good sense, not to say his, as to address you from any such ground. Therefore, perhaps the expression itself, I merely suggest this to you, my dear, may be a little misplaced.
What would you advise me to use in its stead, Father?
Why, my dear Louisa, said Mr. Gradgrind, completely recovered by this time, I would advise you, since you ask me, to consider this question, as you have been accustomed to consider every other question, simply as one of tangible fact. The ignorant and the giddy may embarrass such subjects with irrelevant fancies and other absurdities that have no existence, properly viewed, really no existence. But it is no compliment to you to say that you know better. Now, what are the facts of this case? You are, we will say in round numbers, 20 years of age. Mr. Bounderby is, we will say in round numbers, 50. There is some disparity in your respective years, but in your means and positions there is none. On the contrary, there is a great suitability. Then, the question arises, is this one disparity sufficient to operate as a bar to such a marriage? In considering this question, it is not unimportant to take into account the statistics of marriage, so far as they have yet been obtained, in England and Wales. I find, on reference to the figures, that a large proportion of these marriages are contracted between parties of very unequal ages, and that the elder of these contracting parties is, in rather more than 3/4 of these instances, the bridegroom. It is remarkable as showing the wide prevalence of this law that among the natives of the British possessions in India, also in a considerable part of China and among the Kalmucks of Tartary, the best means of computation yet furnished us by travellers yield similar results. The disparity I have mentioned, therefore, almost ceases to be disparity, and virtually all but disappears.
What do you recommend, Father?
Asked Louisa, her reserved composure not in the least affected by these gratifying results,
that I should substitute for the term I used just now, for the misplaced expression.
Louisa, returned her father, it appears to me that nothing can be plainer. Confining yourself rigidly to fact, the question of fact you state to yourself is, does Mr. Bounderby ask me to marry him? Yes, he does. The sole remaining question, then, is, shall I marry him? I think nothing can be plainer than that.
Shall I marry him? Repeated Louisa, with great deliberation.
Precisely. And it is satisfactory to me, as your father, my dear Louisa, to know that you do not come to the consideration of that question with the previous habits of mind and habits of life that belong to many young women.
No, Father, she returned, I do not.
I now leave you to judge for yourself, said Mr. Gradgrind. I have stated the case, as such cases are usually stated among practical minds. I have stated it as the case of your mother and myself was stated in its time. The rest, my dear Louisa, is for you to decide.
From the beginning, she had sat looking at him fixedly. As he now leaned back in his chair and bent his deep-set eyes upon her in his turn, perhaps he might have seen one wavering moment in her, when she was impelled to throw herself upon his breast and give him the pent-up confidences of her heart. But, to see it, he must have overleaped at a bound the artificial barriers he had for many years been erecting between himself and all those subtle essences of humanity, which will elude the utmost cunning of algebra until the last trumpet ever to be sounded shall blow even algebra to wreck. The barriers were too many and too high for such a leap. With his unbending, utilitarian, matter-of-fact face, he hardened her again.
and the moment shot away into the plumless depths of the past to mingle with all the lost opportunities that had drowned there. Removing her eyes from him, she sat so long looking silently towards the town that he said at length, "Are you consulting the chimneys of the Coketown works, Louisa?" There seems to be nothing there but languid and monotonous smoke. "Yet when the night comes, fire bursts out, Father," she answered, turning quickly. "Of course I know that, Louisa. I do not see the application of the remark." To do him justice, he did not at all. She passed it away with a slight motion of her hand, and concentrating her attention upon him again, said, "Father, I've often thought that life is very short." This was so distinctly one of his subjects that he interposed. "It is short, no doubt, my dear. Still, the average duration of human life is proved to have increased of late years. The calculations of various life assurance and annuity offices, among other figures which cannot go wrong, have established the fact." "I speak of my own life, Father." "Oh, indeed." "Still," said Mr. Gradgrind, "I need not point out to you, Louisa, that it is governed by the laws which govern lives in the aggregate." "While it lasts, I would wish to do the little I can, and the little I am fit for. What does it matter?" Mr. Gradgrind seemed rather at a loss to understand the last four words, replying, "How matter? What matter, my dear?" "Mr. Bounderby," she went on, in a steady, straight way, without regarding this, "asks me to marry him. The question I have to ask myself is, shall I marry him?" "That is so, Father, is it not? You have told me so, Father, have you not?" "Certainly, my dear." "Let it be so. Since Mr. Bounderby likes to take me thus, I am satisfied to accept his proposal. Tell him, Father, as soon as you please, that this was my answer. Repeat it word for word, if you can, because I should wish him to know what I said." "It is quite right, my dear," retorted her father approvingly, "to be exact. I will observe your very proper request. Have you any wish in reference to the period of your marriage, my child?"
"None, Father. What does it matter?"
Mr. Gradgrind had drawn his chair a little nearer to her and taken her hand, but her repetition of these words seemed to strike with some little discord on his ear. He paused to look at her, and still holding her hand, said, "Louisa, I have not considered it essential to ask you one question, because the possibility implied in it appeared to me to be too remote, but perhaps I ought to do so. You have never entertained in secret any other proposal?"
"Father," she returned almost scornfully, "what other proposal can have been made to me? Whom have I seen? Where have I been? What are my heart's experiences?"
"My dear Louisa," returned Mr. Gradgrind, reassured and satisfied, "you correct me justly. I merely wish to discharge my duty."
"What do I know, Father," said Louisa, in her quiet manner, "of tastes and fancies, of aspirations and affections, of all that part of my nature in which such light things might have been nourished? What escape have I had from problems that could be demonstrated and realities that could be grasped?"
As she said it, she unconsciously closed her hand as if upon a solid object, and slowly opened it, as though she were releasing dust or ash. "My dear," assented her eminently practical parent, "quite true, quite true."
"Why, Father," she pursued, "what a strange question to ask me. The baby preference that even I have heard of as common among children has never had its innocent resting place in my breast. You have been so careful of me that I never had a child's heart. You have trained me so well that I never dreamed a child's dream. You have dealt so wisely with me, Father, from my cradle to this hour, that I never had a child's belief or a child's fear."
Mr. Gradgrind was quite moved by his success and by this testimony to it.
"My dear Louisa," said he, "you abundantly repay my care. Kiss me, my dear girl."
So his daughter kissed him. Detaining her in his embrace, he said,
"I may assure you now, my favourite child, that I am made happy by the sound decision at which you have arrived. Mr. Bounderby is a very remarkable man, and what little disparity can be said to exist between you, if any, is more than counterbalanced by the tone your mind has acquired. It has always been my object so to educate you as that you might, while still in your early youth, be, if I may so express myself, almost any age. Kiss me once more, Louisa. Now, let us go and find your mother.
Accordingly, they went down to the drawing-room, where the esteemed lady with no nonsense about her was recumbent as usual, while Sissy worked beside her. She gave some feeble signs of returning animation when they entered, and presently the faint transparency was presented in a sitting attitude. "Mrs. Gradgrind," said her husband, who had waited for the achievement of this feat with some impatience, "allow me to present to you Mrs. Bounderby."
"Oh," said Mrs. Gradgrind, "so you have settled it. Well, I'm sure I hope your health may be good, Louisa, for if your head begins to split as soon as you are married, which was the case with mine, I cannot consider that you are to be envied, though I have no doubt that you think you are, as all girls do. However, I give you joy, my dear, and I hope you may now turn all your illogical studies to good account, I'm sure I do. I must give you a kiss of congratulation, Louisa. But don't touch my right shoulder, for there's something running down it all day long. And now, you see,"
whimpered Mrs. Gradgrind, adjusting her shawls after the affectionate ceremony,
"I shall be worrying myself morning, noon and night to know what I am to call him."
"Mrs. Gradgrind," said her husband solemnly, "what do you mean?"
"Whatever I am to call him, Mr. Gradgrind, when he is married to Louisa. I must call him something. It's impossible," said Mrs. Gradgrind, with a mingled sense of politeness and injury, to be constantly addressing him and never giving him a name. I cannot call him Josiah, for the name is insupportable to me. You yourself wouldn't hear of Joe, you very well know. Am I to call my own son-in-law Mister? Not, I believe, unless the time has arrived when, as an invalid, I am to be trampled upon by my relations. Then what am I to call him?"
Nobody present having any suggestion to offer in the remarkable emergency, Mrs. Gradgrind departed this life for the time being after delivering the following codicil to her remarks already executed. "As to the wedding, all I ask, Louisa, is, and I ask it with a fluttering in my chest which actually extends to the soles of my feet, that it may take place soon. Otherwise I know it's one of those subjects I shall never hear the last of." When Mr. Gradgrind had presented Mrs. Bounderby, Sissy had suddenly turned her head and looked in wonder, in pity, in sorrow, in doubt, in a multitude of emotions towards Louisa. Louisa had known it and seen it without looking at her. From that moment, she was impassive, proud and cold, held Sissy at a distance, changed to her altogether.
Chapter 16. Husband and Wife. Mr. Bounderby's first disquietude on hearing of his happiness was occasioned by the necessity of imparting it to Mrs. Sparsit. He could not make up his mind how to do that, or what the consequences of the step might be. Whether she would instantly depart bag and baggage to Lady Scadgers, or would positively refuse to budge from the premises. Whether she would be plaintive or abusive, tearful or tearing, whether she would break her heart or break the looking-glass, Mr. Bounderby could not all foresee. However, as it must be done, he had no choice but to do it. So, after attempting several letters and failing in them all, he resolved to do it by word of mouth. On his way home, on the evening he set aside for this momentous purpose, he took the precaution of stepping into a chemist's shop and buying a bottle of the very strongest smelling salts.
"By George," said Mr. Bounderby, "if she takes it in the fainting way, I'll have the skin off her nose at all events."
But in spite of being thus forearmed, he entered his own house with anything but a courageous air, and appeared before the object of his misgivings like a dog who was conscious of coming direct from the pantry.
"Good evening, Mr. Bounderby."
"Good evening, ma'am, good evening."
He drew up his chair,
and Mrs. Sparsit drew back hers, as who should say, "Your fireside, sir, I freely admit it. It is for you to occupy it, if you think proper."
"Don't go to the North Pole, ma'am," said Mr. Bounderby.
"Thank you, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit,
and returned, though short of her former position. Mr. Bounderby sat looking at her as, with the points of a stiff, sharp pair of scissors, she picked out holes for some inscrutable ornamental purpose in a piece of cambric, an operation which, taken in connection with the bushy eyebrows and the Roman nose, suggested with some liveliness the idea of a hawk engaged upon the eyes of a tough little bird. She was so steadfastly occupied that many minutes elapsed before she looked up from her work. When she did so, Mr. Bounderby bespoke her attention with a hitch of his head.
"Mrs. Sparsit, ma'am," said Mr. Bounderby,
putting his hands in his pockets and assuring himself with his right hand that the cork of the little bottle was ready for use,
"I have no occasion to say to you that you are not only a lady born and bred, but a devilish sensible woman."
"Sir," returned the lady, "this is indeed not the first time that you have honoured me with similar expressions of your good opinion."
"Mrs. Sparsit, ma'am," said Mr. Bounderby, "I am going to astonish you."
"Yes, sir,"
returned Mrs. Sparsit interrogatively and in the most tranquil manner possible. She generally wore mittens, and she now laid down her work and smoothed those mittens.
"I am going, ma'am," said Bounderby, "to marry Tom Gradgrind's daughter."
"Yes, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit. "I hope you may be happy, Mr. Bounderby." "Oh, indeed I hope you may be happy, sir." And she said it with such great condescension, as well as with such great compassion for him, that Bounderby, far more disconcerted than if she had thrown her workbox at the mirror or swooned on the hearthrug, corked up the smelling salts tight in his pocket and thought, "Now confound this woman. Who could have even guessed that she would take it in this way?"
"I wish with all my heart, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit in a highly superior manner. Somehow she seemed in a moment to have established a right to pity him ever afterwards, "that you may be in all respects very happy."
"Well, ma'am," returned Bounderby with some resentment in his tone, which was clearly lowered, though in spite of himself, "I am obliged to you. I hope I shall be."
"Do you, sir?" said Mrs. Sparsit, with great affability. "But naturally you do. Of course you do."
A very awkward pause on Mr. Bounderby's part succeeded. Mrs. Sparsit sedately resumed her work, and occasionally gave a small cough, which sounded like the cough of conscious strength and forbearance.
"Well, ma'am," resumed Bounderby, "under these circumstances, I imagine it would not be agreeable to a character like yours to remain here, though you would be very welcome here."
"Oh, dear, no, sir. I could on no account think of that."
Mrs. Sparsit shook her head, still in her highly superior manner, and a little changed the small cough, coughing now as if the spirit of prophecy rose within her, but had better be coughed down.
"However, ma'am," said Bounderby, "there are apartments at the bank where a born and bred lady, as keeper of the place, would be rather a catch than otherwise, and if the same terms—"
"I beg your pardon, sir. You were so good as to promise that you would always substitute the phrase annual compliment."
"Well, ma'am, annual compliment. If the same annual compliment would be acceptable there, why, I see nothing to part us, unless you do."
"Sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit, "the proposal is like yourself, and if the position I shall assume at the bank is one that I could occupy without descending lower in the social scale—"
"Why, of course it is," said Bounderby. "If it was not, ma'am, you don't suppose that I should offer it to a lady who has moved in the society you have moved in? Not that I care for such society, you know, but you do."
"Mr. Bounderby, you are very considerate."
"You'll have your own private apartments, and you'll have your coals and your candles and all the rest of it, and you'll have your maid to attend upon you, and you'll have your light porter to protect you, and you'll be what I take the liberty of considering precious comfortable," said Bounderby.
"Sir," rejoined Mrs. Sparsit, "say no more. In yielding up my trust here, I shall not be freed from the necessity of eating the bread of dependence.
She might have said the sweet bread, for that delicate article in a savory brown sauce was her favorite supper.
And I would rather receive it from your